I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Jack Leffler. He's an oral historian, environmentalist, writer, radio producer. And Brian Shields joins us. He is executive director of Amigos Bravos. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So let's talk for a moment about Amigos Bravos. And Amigos Bravos is hosting a lecture series called Water Matters. And actually, Jack is giving the inaugural lecture of this series on Tuesday of next week, Tuesday the 19th of June. What is Amigos Bravos all about?
Well, Amigos Bravos, we're about to celebrate our 25th anniversary next year. So we've been around for 24 years, protecting and restoring New Mexico's waters. Really focus a lot on rivers of New Mexico. More recently, we've moved more to looking at water both underground and surface. And we've had some amazing victories in terms of really protecting New Mexico's rivers. And we're very pleased to come to do some lectures in Santa Fe. I think, educating the public is a real core strategy of ours. And Santa Fe being really the state capital, we want to really work with all Santa Fans to effect change here at the state capital in the state.
Have you been with Amigos Bravos for all 25 years?
I actually have. I was one of the founding members.
That's what I thought. So what was it like? What was New Mexico like in terms of the health of rivers and water when you started out?
Well, when we started out, there weren't any river protection organizations at all in the state. The reason that Amigos Bravos started was because there was a need to really protect rivers, and it was the 20th anniversary of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, and at that time wanted to bring attention to how important wild and scenic rivers were. And that was the 20th anniversary. The Rio Grande was one of the original 10 rivers in New Mexico, so we started that way by protecting the Rio Grande.
What were you protecting it from?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of mining activity that was going on up in the Red River that was affecting the Rio Grande. The Chevron Molycor mine, which now, as a matter of fact, after working on this issue for 24 years, they have a cleanup plan, which is going to cost $1 billion, not a million, but a billion, to clean up the mess that they've made up there that's been killing the Red River. So, these are major projects that we take on that take a lot of time, and that's a really good example of how we approach our work. We hang on to an issue, and we really go after it.
And if it takes 25 years to get somebody to clean up their mess, that means you really got to be in it for the long run.
You have to be there in the long run. I mean, just look at our campaign, which was very successful, reintroducing river otters here to New Mexico. That took 8 years. I mean, you'd think that, Jack would probably just go up to Washington, pick up an otter and bring it down and drop it in the river, right? Yeah. But no, we had to do all these studies, we had to do all this to get approval to reintroduce the river otter, which had been extirpated from New Mexico in the 1950s. It had the last otter in New Mexico was found in the Gila River in the 1950s, and we were able to reintroduce them up to the Rio Grande. Trying to reintroduce them now to the Gila, that's going to take even longer because of endangered species issues down there, which we can address, but the bureaucracy is not set up to address it quickly. So that's that's why it takes a long time to do anything.
Are there actually now otters in the river?
Yes, we reintroduced 33 river otters up on the Rio Pueblo de Taos, and they've made all their way from there down to Cochiti Reservoir and all the way up to Ute Mountain. So they're spread up in some of the tributaries, and those 33 otters. I'm sure that they're having little ones by now. I mean, it was a three-year project that we put in about 10 otters a year for 3 years, and that was really successful.
What do otters do for the river?
They're the top predator. They're the wolf of the river. So people don't like the fact that they actually are the top predator. They keep the river healthy. That's what they do.
How do they do that?
Without them, they really weed out some of the exotic species, the slower moving fish. You've got the crayfish. They really keep the river clean from a lot of cray, you know, over infestation of crayfish. They really, a river with an otter in it is a healthy river. It really is. It makes a huge difference.
Now, another thing that Amigos Bravos has done is basically carried out lawsuits that, for example, there was one that I was reading about that claimed that the city of Albuquerque was diverting water illegally.
That's correct. That's correct. And Jack and I were just talking about this, actually, over lunch. We were just talking about this, that, you know, that's from the San Juan Chama water, which it comes over from the Colorado River, gets pumped across to the Rio Grande, and then serves the populations along the Rio Grande. And it's really an unsustainable system. But we sued the city because they were taking native water, an equivalent amount of native water from the river, and diverting that amount. So they were taking 40,000 acre feet of San Juan Chama water, but they were doing it with another 40,000 acre feet of native water.
What do you mean
that's
by native
water? It's Rio Grande water. It's water that all of the like the, you know, water people that hold, the farmers that hold water rights, really own those water rights, and farmers downstream really depend on that water. It's the native water. It's the water that falls on in the Rio Grande watershed. If you're thinking like a watershed, it's really all the water that feeds all of us here, and it's not imported. If you think of it as the San Juan Chama water is imported water, it's taking away from another watershed and being moved over here. We sued the city of Albuquerque because they were doing that without a permit. And they were saying they were putting it back down at the wastewater treatment facility, but in fact what happens is that in doing that, they actually dry up 16 miles of river right through the city.
And
that's important habitat. And so that's what we're trying to address.
Thinking like a watershed is a term that you've coined that comes from Aldo Leopold, Thinking Like a Mountain. And you are going to release, and we'll hope to get you on the air again in October, a book which is an anthology called Thinking Like a Watershed.
Correct.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when you think like a watershed, you're trying to imagine, by the way, thinking like a watershed is a metaphor for thinking of a greater reality. But to me, thinking like a watershed is imagining a watershed. Our greater watershed of the Rio Grande, the northern Rio Grande, is a beautiful example. It splits the current state of New Mexico right down the middle. If you look at the boundaries of the Rio Grande watershed, you can see precisely the ridge lines along the river that contain this whole watershed. And it's not just the water within it, it's everything else that's within it. It's the geophysical cradle, the biotic community, and all of the atmospheric stuff, all intermingling, always in a state of motion. And to me, that's one of the key issues about the whole thing. If you think like a watershed, you're not thinking in a static way. You're looking at all of the organisms interconnecting within the context of this geophysical cradle that is sustained by the water that comes down through it.
When you talk about it, and we've talked about this before on the radio, and I think it's one of really the most important issues of our time in terms of how we think, you're really talking about thinking like an ecosystem rather than thinking like an engineer. And when you were just talking a moment ago about the Rio Grande, it's like, well, we put the water back 16 miles downstream, but you don't think about the ecosystem of those 16 miles. To the mind of an engineer, or a certain kind of engineer, that makes perfect sense. To an ecosystem, which is really a complex system, it has tremendous repercussions.
To me, one of the things, one of the greatest flaws in our cultural purview is our having specialized in reductionist thinking for so many centuries at this point. So that we see, we take simply the scientific point of view, and we're following the scientific look at any given species within the context of something. Frequently, the bigger synthesis doesn't happen in the mind of the scientists. One of the things I wanted to mention, this is something I'm really thinking a lot about. Back in 1998, I had the opportunity to interview Edward O. Wilson. He had just finished his book entitled Consilience, which is a jumping together of disciplines. That's what the word means. And Wilson was thinking in terms of a jumping together of science, humanities, the arts, all within a given system. But what he failed to include in that is what I'm really hoping somebody's going to snap to here sooner or later, which is the importance of indigenous mind within this mix, because it's indigenous mind that has evolved within the context of a given watershed or a given ecosystem. And it's an enormous amount of influence that shaped a culture. Say, if you take the Tewa culture along the northern Rio Grande, the Pueblos along the northern Rio Grande, and you talk to people who live within that culture, who are imbued with that sense of Tewa culture, you really do understand a much deeper and broader perspective in which the reductionist point of view can fit, but only as one small factor. The idea is to be able to see all of these factors in some sense of coherence. And so that's basically the project that's coming next for me, is a book on coherence, a greater coherence.
I've been reading the newest book by Martin Prechtel, who is a wonderful thinker, who I hope to have on the air sometime. I haven't yet started that process, but who writes a great deal about these kinds of issues and about indigenous ways of thinking about, and the word ecosystems doesn't come up, just about land, culture, water, all of these things that make us who we are and the connections among all these different species. And one of the things that has come out for me and that's made me think a lot is that, I mean, you talk about indigenous mind, you're talking about indigenous languages. And indigenous languages, my guess is, and what I'm beginning to gather is, have a capacity for talking about those things in a way that allows you to think like a watershed, to think like an ecosystem. And the English or European languages, we have to maybe struggle a little more to do so.
You know, you're right. One of the projects that we're doing, we have I'd mentioned this to Brian earlier, our 501c3 is called The Lore of the Land. And one of the things that we're doing right now is getting funding to help a Tewa language project. The language itself is a verb-based language, which to me implies an activist point of view, an activist cultural point of view.
Yeah.
But it's activists within the context of the culture which spawned it. And a person for whom I have enormous respect is Rena Swenzel, who, by the way, has written a contributing chapter in our new book, Thinking Like a Watershed. And talking to a Hopi friend of mine, Lyle Balenqua, who's a traditional Hopi person who also has a degree in archaeology, he tells me that the Hopi language contains concepts which are unavailable to be thought if you're thinking in English or in one of the European languages.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I have a kind of optimistic feeling about translation. I think that a lot of things can be translated if you use the poetry of your own language and talk to each other enough. But the fact is that we are in an English-based, in this country, language and culture and way of thinking, and we have this reductionism. And I mean, I'm quite fond of science and scientists and think that they contribute a great deal, and that the language and reality in which they work, and they're also, by and large, pretty darn smart people, the language and context in which they work should be and is open to thinking about things in a more holistic way, is it not?
Well, it is. If you really do pursue the whole sense of consilience that Edward O. Wilson was talking about, I've been working with a bunch of scientists lately, interviewing them about their various disciplines, including Melissa Savage, who was very much a part of the Otter project, and continues to be, and hopefully down in the Gila, the otters will be. I remember running a river with Melissa back in 1973. She said, "We need otters here."
That's right. That's Melissa. We do. That's great.
Based
That's
on great. What? What did she mean?
Well,
she saw that the river health wasn't what it should be?
She recognized that the ecosystem was incomplete because the otters were no longer there. And then she went on to get a PhD in biogeography. Now, there is a discipline that puts together a lot of different reductionist thoughts, so to speak, in a bigger picture. It's a great way of looking at things. And I concur with you that we live in a Western culturally based, by that I mean a largely European-based culture. But one of the things that is possible to do is to help restore culture at large by factoring in the bigger picture of what it intuitively means to understand your relationship to homeland. And that's what the native people can teach us.
And I think based on that, the concepts are one of the commons, and what is a common, you know, it belongs to everybody. And the problem that we have right here is that we've lost that. We've lost that vision of the commons, although New Mexico is a great example of where the commons still exists in terms of the native tribes and ownership of land, ownership of water, and the acequias, the Hispanic acequias, the way they share the water. But there aren't very many of those examples anymore, and we've lost that concept. It's almost kind of like it's been taken over by the almighty dollar, so everything has a price to it now. You know, water has a price to it. As soon as you start looking at the ecology, at the natural resources, as having a price associated with it, we're bound to lose it because there's going to be huge competition for it.
Well, the thing is, there is this whole concept which we've talked about quite a bit, namely ecosystem services, and in which they do put a dollar price on, for example, forests and land that filters water and bees pollinate and all of these things that wildlife and wild species just do without being paid. And if they were to not do them, if we were to wipe out their lands, it would, if it could be done at all, cost billions, if not trillions of dollars. And there's a way of looking at that where it's really positive to put a dollar value on preserving wild areas.
Yeah, we have to do that now. I mean, that's the only way we know how to talk about it anymore. You know, we can't just talk about it as a real value other than the money value. When you put the money value on it, then you lose out on the cultural values, you lose out on, you know, spiritual values, you lose out on all these other values that you really can't put a price on. And, you know, that's an issue.
I think that actually, what that says to me is that putting that sort of an economic view of reality is itself an unnatural act because it excludes so much more. We are the keystone species, the human species, but that's all we are.
Well, we are a keystone species. I was thinking about that because prairie dogs are a keystone species, wolves are a keystone species, and what they do, for example, is make it possible for all these other species to exist. Sometimes I wonder if we aren't the opposite. We are extincting all these other species.
We are. However, we have the opportunity, it's still not too late, at least in my humble opinion, to turn that around. And actually, when you look at the planet itself, it's the planet, that's the mosaic of habitats, of watersheds, of ecosystems, which has spawned all life, that in relationship to the sun. And in a sense, you can look at the Earth itself as a living organism. And as, again, Edward O. Wilson points out, if our species is the species that has achieved the greatest level of consciousness yet known on the planet, perhaps we could construe ourselves to be the mind of the planet. But we'd better get ourself together in a pretty good way here, because if the mind of the planet commits suicide for the planet, that's not a good thing at all. We have to really
start. We kind of seem to be doing that.
We do, but we have to turn it around. Now, it gets ever more critical. When I was born, the population of the planet was 2 billion. Yeah, so it's more than trebled in my lifetime. And that's an amazing thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, when you talk about turning it around, I mean, that's a metaphor of like a vehicle. You're turning a vehicle around. Or when you're talking about basically teaching people whole new ways of thinking. Thinking like a watershed is part of that. Thinking like an ecosystem. What's in the way of getting people to think like that more?
I'd like to offer this, because Brian and I were talking about this over lunch, but About 2 years ago, I did a radio program on the life of Aldo Leopold in the Southwest. And he got his basic training as an ecologist thinker in the Carson National Forest. He was a supervisor for the Carson National Forest. He spent a lot of time thinking about what he saw. One of the things I got to do was interview his daughter, Estella Leopold, who told me that when she was a kid in the 1930s and 40s, by this time Aldo and family had bought Sand County Farm, where he wrote the Sand County Almanac, and he actually began the practice of restoration ecology by looking at the surrounding ecosystem and seeing how things fit together. And subsequently, they as a family, all seven of them, the five kids and the parents, went out every weekend and restored a burnt-out farm. And it is now a living ecosystem, a perfect example of what can be done. And so restoration ecology, and this is something that I know Brian is really interested in with regard to the Taos River watershed, restoration ecology goes a long way toward cultural restoration at the same time.
Right.
In other words, if people can become involved in going out and fixing it. Another concept here that I think is really important to do at the same time is to understand that we have centralized our political power to such an extent in Washington, D.C., that we no longer have a real sense of a decentralized political foothold right here in our home watershed. And so I hearken back to the times of John Wesley Powell when he was saying in the 1880s and 90s that we should organize the arid west, that is west of the 100th meridian, by watersheds rather than the state geopolitically bounded states that we have today.
And that goes back to thinking like an ecosystem versus thinking like an engineer. An engineer draws straight lines, and that's what state boundaries turned out to be. I mean, his map, which is beautiful and fascinating, and I've looked at it a lot. You gave me one years ago, and I still have it, and look at it. Has these crazy boundaries that are very hard to draw that are the boundaries of watersheds. And as you say, ridge lines and things like that, whereas the map of the West is basically a bunch of very straight lines that run north-south or else east-west, and they have nothing to do with the natural terrain that they cut across.
That's absolutely true.
And Wesley lost.
He lost to entrepreneurs who wanted to develop the American West. In other words, it was that economically driven paradigm that was taking over big time. If you go back even a century or not quite a century earlier, a century earlier, Jefferson himself was the person who surveyed the West. And it was he who established privatization of landscape. And it was also he who addressed getting rid of the Native American points of view of regard to homeland, to the land itself. And this is Thomas Jefferson, who is on one level a hero of mine, really didn't do anybody any favors on that level.
I think that one of the ways to address these issues is really by engaging people, different disciplines, to really come together and talk about these issues. And that's one of the whole ideas behind these lectures, Water Matters lecture series, which we'll do the third Tuesday of every month here in Santa Fe at the Randall Davies Center. And we hope to do that, you know, throughout the next year. So we'll have different speakers speaking about different aspects of it. I mean, Jack's going to start off with thinking like a watershed. Then we have, in July, we'll have Dr. Jose Rivera, who will talk about the history and importance of acequias. And then in August, Michael Jensen will speak about pharmaceuticals in New Mexico waters. We hope to cover a whole different kind of broad spectrum of issues, mostly affecting New Mexico's waters, but also bringing in some perspectives on issues internationally as well. I know in the fall we're going to have E.J. Levy, who's the winner of the Flannery O'Connor Award, and she's going to read from a memoir of her experiences doing conservation work in the Amazon. And you know, so we get different perspectives and we start to open up the possibilities of how to protect New Mexico's waters and look at it not just from the scientific perspective, but from the arts as well. And I mean, I think it's really important that the arts become part of that conversation, because It's the artist who really looks at a problem and sees ways to fix it that are go way beyond that linear aspect that you were just talking about. You know, it's new. Most of our ecological problems come from just people's mindsets, where it's habits, really. It's really from a habit of doing certain things in certain places.
Right.
And then if we can change that habit and start thinking in terms of more like a watershed.
Well, I think, and it makes it sound like I'm sort of anti-engineer, which is not the case at all, because engineers do wonderful things like build bridges and build roads and all these things that we need and that are terrific. And I think that a lot of what is needed is to think about the appropriate approach to any problem. So there's this thing, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail,
right,
that we right. use. And basically the people who are in charge of defining the problem get to solve it in their ways. And I think that part of what you guys are doing is redefining what the problems are and giving us new tools of thought to address that.
One of the things, apropos of what you're saying, that I think is extremely important, and Brian and I are, again, we're talking about this, but to me, in the current milieu, law itself is designed to define and defend a point of view that is largely driven by economics rather than the ecosystem itself, which is an erroneous way of thinking. Subsequently, what we are creating as legal acts are actually unnatural acts. And it seems to me that when law and nature collide, it's best to go with nature.
But I mean, you've got the Endangered Species Act and you've got good laws.
Those are the two or three good laws. Now, we have a lot of laws. I mean, I obey traffic laws, believe it or not. And
it is hard to believe, yes.
But the point is that there's an awful lot of law out there that is supporting corporate enterprises, because the corporate people are able to fund the legislators to pay off legislature to create a law to basically justify ripping off as much habitat as possible. In other words, to turn habitat into money is not a good thing.
Turning habitat into money is one of the Jack Leffler mantras that I have always thought about. Once you've said that, I mean, it makes you realize that just the way I live in a house with a couple of bedrooms and a bathroom and a kitchen and a yard, animals live in a house, which isn't a house. It's trees and ground and grass and water, and it's their house just as much as my house is my house. And when you do something with it and don't understand that, it's like displacing somebody in war. It's like bulldozing somebody's house.
Exactly. Once I watched a bulldozer bulldoze a Navajo woman's hogan, wherein she'd lived for 70 years.
Oh.
And it got bulldozed and she fainted dead away. Mm-hmm. It was profound.
We're talking to Jack Leffler and Brian Shields. The kind of transition that you're talking about to a more ecosystem-friendly society is, I mean, honestly, it's something that many conscious people think about all the time, but the idea of actually implementing it is so daunting that you almost don't know what to do besides just talk about it.
Well, that's a good point. And I think, you know, I was telling Jack this because we've got a project that we started up in Taos now where we have four artists that are developing this project to clean up an area that's been really heavily trashed. And it's a deep arroyo. It's one of the most beautiful places you can imagine. And the realization was we were going to go in there, pick up the trash and turn it into sculptures to stop vehicles from getting to the edge there. And, you know, so these are ideas that we've got going. But we've had to back up a minute, because what needs to happen is that dialogue of why is this trash happening and how do we stop it from happening, not just by stopping vehicles, but by stopping people from going there and, you know, and using it as a trash dump instead of as a church. And so we've decided to start the dialogue by putting up these cans. It's a can telephone these toucans with a long string across this huge big chasm, right? This deep arroyo with all the trash in it. So there's, you go up there, and we've got this can phone, but you can go up and talk across this chasm about, you know, the problem. And I think that that's the whole idea, in a way, of these lecture series, is to begin dialogues on different issues, continue those dialogues, really, and get more people involved. And here in Santa Fe, it's perfect because, of course, this is the state capital. This is where decisions are made. So there's a lot of people that can just walk down to the state capital and really talk to the decision makers.
Brian Shields is executive director of Amigos Bravos, which is on the web at amigosbravos.org. And Jack Loeffler is an oral historian, environmentalist, writer, and radio producer. And he will be speaking on Tuesday, June 19th. It's about thinking like a watershed. It's the first of the lecture series called Water Matters. And it's at the Randall Davies Audubon Center at 7 in the evening. And then there will be many more, which you can find out about by going to amigosbravos.org or calling 575-758-3874. And before we go, we also want to let people know that there is a raffle, and you can go to the website and get raffle tickets, and if you buy some extra ones, your chances of winning go way up, and it's an amazing set of
it's
prizes.
Our biggest fundraiser of the year, and we highly encourage people to come out. They can buy tickets at the lecture.
Oh, good. You can buy tickets at the lecture.
Because the drawing is on the 21st, so people have to buy tickets right away.
Okay.
And
so
what kind of stuff? What kind of stuff?
Well, you know, it's a choice between a trip to Peru or an acre of land in northern New Mexico or $3,000 cash. So
take
your pick.
Right on.
Gentlemen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Harry Charlotte.